I'll call our 10 o'clock docket. The case is 2006 CA2580, People Against Tucker. Counsel, have you received and had an opportunity to read our standard instructions?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are there any questions?
Everyone
in the audience, please make sure your cell phones and pagers are turned off. The appellant may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nathaniel Deakins, registration number 38752 on behalf of Mr. Tucker, the appellant. Subject to your questions, Your Honors, I would like to address issues numbers 1 and 3 in the opening brief. I will rest on the briefs as to the second issue, the sufficiency of the evidence, although I do believe that that comes into play in the discussion of the other issues. So, the first issue is whether the trial court erred by allowing Mr. Tucker's Montana lawyer to testify regarding the contents of the letter Mr. Tucker sent to him, and by allowing the prosecution to introduce the letter through this lawyer's testimony. The third issue involves the exclusion of an expert witness on behalf of Mr. Tucker. As an initial matter, Your Honors, the privilege, the attorney-client privilege, is a testimonial privilege. So this privilege applies at the time that the attorney is to testify, is to be examined.
By the way, there was no objection when the attorney was called to testify, was there, Mr. Deakin?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the pretrial motion, this was extensively litigated prior to trial.
There was a motion to suppress, which was denied.
There was.
And when the attorney was called to testify, there was no objection at that time.
Well, Your Honor, defense counsel below raised a specific motion to preclude Mr. Newhart from testifying to any client privilege matters.
I'm not saying you waived the argument. I'm only suggesting what we're here on is the correctness or the incorrectness of the motion, the ruling on the motion to suppress. Nothing about admission of evidence, abuse of discretion on the evidence. We're here on the motion to suppress.
I believe that's one reason we're here, Your Honor, but I do believe that my argument that is raised was preserved.
Okay.
Which is that Mr. Tucker's attorney-client privilege, or his right to have privileged communications with his attorney, was violated. The statutory right, 1390.107.1b, that his attorney shall not be examined about confidential matters, communications between Mr. Tucker and his attorney.
Well, my point, Mr. Deakins, is that the trial court made findings at the time it ruled on the motion to suppress, and unless those are clearly erroneous, we're bound by those findings. And that's a whole different standard, I think, than should evidence be allowed or not allowed at the time that it's offered. That's a question of abuse of discretion.
Well, I think that the standard to apply to factual findings is clearly erroneous. However, I believe that the findings of the trial court that these communications were not privileged is not merely a factual matter. It's, does this statute extend to this situation? Now, I think that's a de novo standard. I can understand why there may be an argument, as the Attorney General argues, that it's abuse of discretion. However, I don't think it's merely just a factual determination. The trial court, it was the trial court's responsibility to determine whether the privilege applied. That's a CRE 104A. And generally, that's by preponderance of the evidence standard. So Mr. Tucker had the burden of establishing by preponderance of the evidence that the privilege applied. Now, once that was established, and I will get into that, then the proponent of any exception, which was the district attorney in this case, they bear the burden of establishing that an exception applies. So it touches the crime fraud exception or the or a waiver. The general rule, as Mr. Tucker bore the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence, an attorney shall not be examined without the consent of his client as to any communication made by the client to him or his advice given thereon in the course of employment. First question is whether this was a communication from Mr. Tucker to Mr. Newhart. And I can see, Judge Richmond, why you asked the question about the procedural posture of this case, because by the time of this hearing, it was clear that Mr. Tucker had written this letter. In fact, Mr. Tucker never denied writing the letter. Now, so...
But the judge made a finding that it was not an attorney-client communication. He made that preliminary finding, didn't he, at the time denied the motion, or she, I guess, denied the motion to suppress?
Correct, and that's why I think we're getting into a matter of law here.
So why was the judge wrong? What was clearly erroneous about her finding that this was not a, did not purport to be a communication from a client to his lawyer? That was Judge Swift's finding, I think.
Yes, Your Honor. The judge found that it did not purport to be from Mr. Tucker, and my first argument is that it's irrelevant who it purports to be from because it is from Mr. Tucker, as a matter of fact. Now, I think when you're getting into deception, and I think the crime fraud exception adequately deals with situations where the letter is so disingenuous or it promotes a crime, but I don't get into that later. But again, at the time of the hearing, it was established and that Mr. Tucker did write the letter. So it doesn't matter. The judge erred in finding that it mattered or it was a relevant consideration of who it purported to be from.
At the time that the Montana attorney received it, however, didn't have that information. All that attorney had was this letter, which purports to be from the district attorney, not from the client.
I think as a factual matter, I disagree that the letter purports to be from District Attorney Komar, and because I think there's inconsistent evidence as to who it's from. But before reaching that...
Can you explain that?
Well, the letter, you have a copy of the letter. It's in an envelope addressed from Mr. Tucker, and it's not written in a manner that a district attorney would write a letter. So we have the judge finding that no reasonable attorney would think that this is from a district attorney. We have this expert witness who said no reasonable attorney would think this is from a district attorney. We have Mr. Newhart's testimony, the lawyer, who said at first he was confused and concerned by the letter. And I think a check of the record will ensure this, but I think he gave conflicting testimony as to what he thought when he first got it. He said he was concerned for the safety of the judge. So I think the record indicates that no one thought that this was from Peter Komar.
Mr. Deakins, isn't that a question for the trial judge at that point in the hearing? I mean, essential to this judge's ruling at the motion in limine is factually what's happening here. Doesn't the court have to make some preliminary fact-finding?
Certainly.
And when the court does that, then our standard of review would be clearly erroneous, correct?
As to factual findings.
As to the factual findings, and then the court applies the law to the findings as the court has found them.
Yes.
And your argument here is which? That his factual findings were clearly erroneous, or that he misapplied the law to the facts that he found, or both?
Both, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I agree that the standard of review for factual findings is clearly erroneous. And Judge Marquez, I think that judge clearly erred in finding that this letter purports to be from District Attorney Komar. But setting that aside, the judge erred in finding that who the letter purports to be from is a relevant consideration at the time that the motion is considered and at the time that Mr. Newhart is called to give testimony against his own client. I think.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that if a letter purports to be from somebody else, but in fact it's really from the client to the attorney, that retains its privilege? Is there any case that says anything like that?
I haven't found a significantly analogous case, Your Honor. I'm relying on the wording of the statute that the issue is, the privilege is a testimonial privilege, and I think I did cite a California case for that proposition.
Well, there's no question it's a testimonial privilege. Right?
Right. And so that the issue is whether the attorney can be called, it does all come back to whether the contents of the letter were privileged. So I do agree with that, because if the contents of the letter were not privileged, then even when he's called, he's not there. The privilege isn't violated. So I do want to get into that. I think that I cited a Massachusetts case in the reply brief, and I think that's a very persuasive and instructive case on this matter, because it applies a rule or set of rules that are reasonable, that account for the interests involved and the policies underlying these, the attorney-client privilege and the exception, the crime fraud exception. And in that case, just to remind the court, an attorney represented a client in a neglect proceeding. The client left some threatening voicemail messages on the attorney's answering machine. The attorney, out of fear for, in fact, it was a judge in that case, out of fear for the safety of the judge, reported those messages, or the substance of those messages, to the sheriff's department, I believe it was. And the Supreme Court of Massachusetts said that was fine. The attorney had discretion to do that. But the state can't turn around and use those statements against the client in a criminal proceeding, because the state's attorney then used those statements to file an information charging threats to commit a crime. Because the purposes underlying the attorney-client, well, first the court found that those are legitimate communications. I think underlying all this, once this prosecution got going, once Mr. Komar, indeed, actually is the one who filed the charges, once this prosecution got going, it sort of seemed to pick up steam that, well, the prosecutor's theory is what really happened in this case. This was a threatening communication.
But in that case, it is the client communicating via this message was left on the phone to the attorney, right?
There was no issue as to the identity of the client in that case.
Right, but here you got a letter that purports to be from the district attorney.
I'm not standing up here, Your Honor, and arguing that this wasn't a strange letter, this wasn't a misguided letter, or ill-advised. What I'm saying is this court shouldn't get into a trial court should not get into the business of determining what is legitimate and illegitimate communication between a client and attorney if it doesn't rise to the level of a crime or...
Well, let me take that since we're running out of time here. Why isn't this letter, let's assume you're right, let's just say it's an attorney-client communication, everybody knew it, fine. Wasn't intended to be disclosed, fine. Why doesn't it get disclosed under the crime fraud exception? Isn't this letter discoverable or allowed to be disclosed by the attorney under the crime fraud exception?
Well, Your Honor, I think...
I know the judge didn't make a finding on that, but we can affirm on any grounds that's permissible.
I agree.
Why can't, and the state argues it, and you replied a little bit in your reply brief, but why isn't this discoverable or permissible, or producible, I should say, admissible under the crime fraud exception?
First of all, Your Honor, I think that the crime fraud exception applies to whether the attorney can testify to the statements, not whether the attorney can disclose them. I think that is a matter of ethical rule, whether the attorney can, you know, I'm scared for this judge's safety, I'm going to go notify somebody. And now...
Well, there's a law in this state that the crime fraud exception erases the attorney-client privilege. You take the cases yourself, I think, or
yes,
the state that...
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
And so the crime fraud exception, the assuming, as you said, that the attorney, we've established the basic principles of the attorney-client privilege, and now we're getting into the exception. The DA was required to show by preponderance of the evidence that the crime fraud exception applies. So the burden shifts there.
By making a prima facie case.
A foundation, in fact. The cases cited by the Attorney General are quite distinct from Mr. Tucker's situation. So, for example, People v. Board, in that case, there was a foundation, in fact, established where the defendant and the attorney consulted and prepared a false affidavit together to be used in a grand jury investigation. In the situation of law offices of Bernard Morley, an ongoing investigation of a lawyer and client revealed they were running sham corporations for local taverns, and the police were investigating Mr. Morley, I believe. The letter itself is all that the prosecution has put forth to establish that Mr. and Tucker intended Mr. Newhart to somehow threaten Judge Todd.
Doesn't the letter threaten Judge Todd?
It doesn't threaten Judge Todd. No, it does not. I think that's important.
We will be filing on Judge Todd, it says. If Mr. Tucker was affected adversely in any way, Judge Todd's career will end. If Mr. Todd and the state of Montana want to ignore the totality of the circumstance in this case, as well as ignore the decision of other states, we will act in kind. The resources of the state of Colorado will protect them. We will do everything the county attorney does. You don't think those are threats to Judge Todd and to the county attorney in Montana? This I'm reading from the letter here.
Well, this is an important distinction, and that's why I say I don't stand up here saying that this letter is not strange and concerning. but it is not a threat to Judge Todd, because this letter was sent to Mr. Newhart. And it does not ask or encourage Mr. Newhart to do anything about that. And it's there, and then we're getting into the sufficiency of the evidence as well, because the elements of the crime were not established beyond a reasonable doubt. The letter was sent to Mr. Newhart, I'm repeating myself here, because it's, well, at its base, it's a very simple matter. There was no substantial step taken. This letter was sent to Mr. Newhart. There are no explicit instructions, and the prosecution's argument below and the Attorney General's argument here, that this implies, that it's implied in this letter that Mr. Newhart do something, is simply not there. I would reserve time, but I don't have any more. And then subject to your questions, conclude my argument.
Thank you. I have one question I will ask you, so you didn't argue it. On the expert witness, the judge's ruling was that if the defendant was going to get up there and testify about his knowledge of Rule 1.6, it might come in. At trial, when the expert was, when the defendant did testify. My understanding is after the defendant testified, they never tried again to get that expert witness report or the expert witness testimony. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, just, I would argue that the pretrial ruling was sufficient to preserve that argument for appeal, and that because
it wasn't preserved. I just wanted to understand the record whether the defendant, having made the decision to testify and did testify, and actually testified about his understanding of what the attorney's obligation was, they never again tried to get that expert testimony in.
Yes, that's my understanding of the record.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, and I represent the people in this matter. I'd like to start by clearing up perhaps a procedural issue with respect to the admissibility of the letter and the attorney's testimony at trial. My understanding of the attorney-client privilege, that statute, and in case law is that if this court concludes that the letter wasn't privileged, and I believe I pointed out in my brief, I don't believe that the attorney testified to any additional potentially privileged communications, then there isn't any error with respect to the attorney's testimony. It seems to me that the defendant's asking for a different ruling with respect to privilege at the time of trial versus at the time that there was a suppression issue, and the people's position is that they're really one and the same. So I'll be talking about this in terms of the admissibility of the letter. The people's position is that this letter wasn't an attorney-client privilege communication, and I think that finding of the trial court is supported by the record. I think the defendant wrote a letter pretending to be someone else, a public official, a district attorney, which implies that he had discussed the case with this district attorney. I don't think that this was a client communication. The trial court's finding was that the attorney's reaction to this letter was quite reasonable, reasonableness being a question of fact. That finding isn't clearly erroneous. The attorney-client privilege only applies to statements that are made in circumstances giving rise to a reasonable expectation that the statements will be treated as confidential. And I think the trial court's finding with respect to that issue is supported by the record.
The judge knew by the time she ruled on the motion to suppress that this letter had actually been written by the client, so to speak, by Mr. Tucker, right?
Yes.
So at what point in time is she supposed to consider whether it is a communication from a client to an attorney or not? At the time she makes the ruling or at the time the letter is written? Or is there any case law that tells us what that time differential decision is?
I believe I cited some cases on this issue in my brief, but my understanding is that the ruling is made by looking at the circumstances as appeared to at the time the communication was made.
Okay.
And then secondly, I think that's the first basis that this communication was admissible and the trial court's ruling was correct because it wasn't privileged in the first place, and that was the defendant's burden to prove. And then secondly, I don't think this letter was privileged because it fell within the crime fraud exception. And I recognize that the trial court didn't rule on this basis, but the prosecutor below certainly did argue it. And I think all the prosecution had to show with respect to the crime fraud exception was a prima facie showing, a foundation in fact. And here we have undisputed facts that the defendant stole official stationery from the Alamosa County DA, forged a letter pretending to be the DA, and then made on their face threatening statements against a Montana judge. And I think that's certainly enough to have a foundation in fact.
Do the threatening statements have to be the threat of physical harm, or can you simply make a threat of some kind of action that might be legal or illegal?
My understanding under Colorado case law is that the communications need to be a showing that communications are made for the purpose of aiding the commission of a future crime or a present continuing crime. I don't believe that there's any requirement that the statements threaten physical harm.
But you're saying that one of the crimes is a threat. And your opposing counsel saying there's no threat here, no threat to the judge. I mean, I understand the fraud piece of this, okay, and not questioning that there's fraud written all over this and that the judge could find that there was fraud here. But you're saying also that there is a threat against Judge Todd. Your opponent is saying, no, this is not a threat against Judge Todd. And my first question is, if you're relying on threat, does it need to be a threat of physical harm?
My understanding of the case law, it doesn't need to be a threat of physical harm, but I think certainly in this letter, I mean, there are some pretty wild accusations in that letter, and one of them is that the judge's career would end. I mean, does that mean, the judge is going to be killed? I don't know.
We hear that all the time.
I've never gotten a letter like that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. Thrown me off a little bit. But that's the extent of my argument with respect to the first issue. And briefly, with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, it seems to me that all of the defendant's claims in this case operate from his insistence that this letter was a joke. It was obvious it was a joke. Everybody should have put that together that it was a joke. And I feel like at this point, that ship has sailed. The jury listened to the defendant's testimony, judged his credibility, heard his theory of the case, and rejected them. And this court is not in a position to overturn the jury's finding as to the defendant's intent, which is a question of fact. And the people are content to rest on the brief with respect to the expert testimony issue, unless this court has any questions.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. At the motion limiting hearing, I think it was Judge Swift again, kept out the expert testimony, saying that unless the defendant comes forward and testifies that he was relying on Rule 1.6 of the Rules of Professional Conduct, that he knew what it said, unless he comes forward and says that, I'm not going to let this expert witness testify because it doesn't matter. It seemed to me at the time that put the defendant in kind of a Hobson's choice. He had to decide, will I testify at trial? Will I not testify at trial? Here, we're way before trial. I wonder whether the judge should have reconsidered at trial, the defendant having testified, whether that expert should be allowed. But I take it the defendant never raised that. That's what defense counsel tells me.
Your Honor, I don't remember specifically. I mean, my understanding is that the issue wasn't brought up again after the defendant testified. Certainly it would be. The defendant wanted a reconsideration of that ruling after his testimony. He, could have sought such a ruling. But I think, in addition, that there were several other bases for excluding this expert's testimony. But with respect to this testimony being helpful to the jury, I don't believe that the defendant testified that he was familiar with the Montana Rules of Professional Conduct and relied on them when he sent the letter. I mean, there was some suggestion based on this expert's report that, Montana doesn't have the crime fraud exception, and they were perhaps trying that angle, but I don't believe the defendant's testimony said that he was aware of various rules of professional conduct, and that was the reason that he thought this would be kept quiet.
No, in fact, he testified that he expected the attorney would not disclose this, but he didn't cite the Montana rules for that. He said common sense tells me that the attorney wouldn't disclose it, and he did testify to that. And they did argue that closer.
Certainly, and I believe I brought that up in, with respect to an argument of harmlessness, but I certain the defense certainly argued up and down that he thought that this would be kept confidential. If the court has no further questions, people would ask that the judgment of conviction be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Your case now stands submitted.